Welcome to Good Areas Podcast. This is the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber. This is the cricket podcast in which we answer your questions. The best way to do that, of course, is via Patreon, which is patreon.com/goodareaspodcast. You can find us all there and you can sign up, and there's other stuff as well. You get access to our emailer and our Discord channel as well. There's lots of things. There's many things. If you don't want to do all of that, of course, and not everyone likes Patreon or regular signups, and you want to ask a question, the other thing is, if you are live, you can just pop in with a super chat or just a normal chat, a chat at any stage during the recording as well. But Ali went over to Patreon and he says, if you're a new captain, like Shah Masood, and you're learning how to read a pitch, how would you go about it in a place where pitches can vary a lot? No history to go, so how can you dodge a pitch without looking like an amateur? Look, I believe in this sort of stuff very differently than most people. I think I was asked the other day, you know, is reading pitches a science? And look, I'm not saying there aren't people who are better or worse than at it, because I do believe that's the case. But when it comes down to it, it's mostly bullshit. generally, you're going on what the pitch has done over a long period of time. And then you're looking at any signs that back that up or don't back that up. And what a pitch looks like. I remember one of my favorite ones was the Australian team. People from inside the camp contacted me in 2017. And they said, when we got to Ranchi, look at this wicket. No, sorry. Yeah, well, actually, I think that is true. But look at this wicket. Look at the color it is. And I remember other people in the media going, look at the color it is. It's going to spin sideways. And I said, why does that color mean it's going to spin? It was this really weird brownie color. I remember that wicket really clearly. And they were like, look at the color. And I'm like, what makes you think that is going to spin? And it ended up being maybe one of the funnest wickets I've ever seen. So the Australians got there and were convinced it was going to be ragging sideways like the last two wickets had. And it didn't. And, you know, there were some very good cricket minds in the Australian camp and around the Australian camp and cricket journalists who, you know, maybe should have known better and not just taken everything verbatim. But regardless of that, there's a lot of smart people that all got that wicket wrong. And I've been around cricket for so long and seen so many people get things wrong that when it comes down to it, I just don't really think there is a way of doing it. Truth is, there are some people like maybe Ross Taylor and Kane Williamson who just naturally have the gift. And I'm not sure it's something that you can learn. You probably either have it or you don't. But realistically, I think it's probably one of the more overrated things. Once you're playing on it, it's much easier to work it out. At the toss, it is just a guess. Ruja doesn't say. Who would win a 5-test series between 11 Andrew Matthews and 11 Shane Watsons? At their primes, I assume by current form, Matthews would win. Also, who do you think would be the better keeper? In their prime, I'll probably take the 11 Shane Watsons because I think they're more likely to get wickets, aren't they? I mean, you're talking about prime Shane Watson is bowling 90 miles an hour, right? So if you're taking his prime bowling, I don't think he was as good a batter as Angelo Matthews, but I don't think he was that far away. And Angelo Matthews is a really handy bowler. Don't think he was anywhere near Shane Watson's level at that point. So yeah, I think if I was going to do that, Rudra, I would pick the Shane Watsons. Who would I assume is the better keeper would be Angelo Matthews, because I would just think that Shane Watson trying to wicket keep would break an arm or a leg or snap in half. Sam says, what is your least favourite cricket ground you've attended by the merits of the ground, not your experience there, both as a professional and a fan? I suppose I kind of love the Wacker and hate the Wacker at the same time. The facilities there were terrible. And when you say, you know, not your your experience there, there's no way to separate those, right? Like, I was choked at the Wacker. I'm never going to not remember being choked by a woman at the Wacker because she thought I was going the wrong direction. So something like that is, you know, always part of it. But I also remember, and I can't remember who it was, but someone from the Indian camp, like some liquid fell on them from the floor above. It was just putrid by the end, the Wacker. And, you know, that weird press tent that they had where it was like 4,000 degrees, all these different things come in. So my experiences do play a part in that. What other cricket grounds? I'm trying to think of any others that are just bad. I mean, I don't particularly like the Gabba either. I wouldn't say the facilities are bad, but it just doesn't have a good energy. I don't know how to explain the Gabba. I've just never felt all that comfortable there. Try to think of some of the other countries, some weirder ones. I mean, Pisa I kind of love, but obviously shouldn't have international cricket. So that would be quite high up there. Trying to think if there's any grounds in India that I don't like, or South Africa. But yeah, the Wacket stands out. But it's based on it falling apart, really, as much as anything. Yeah, I'm not sure I have a great answer for that one. Satchmo says, Jack Hobbs averaged 50.5 against Warwick Armstrong's Australians in 1920-21 in a 5-0 loss. Is that still the greatest away performance by an England batter? I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how high I have that. I don't think I've ever... See, a question like that requires me to have gone through the greatest away performances by English batters, right? And I don't think I have. I'd be interested to see what Gooch did against the West Indies, because I know he's a fantastic record against West Indies. I don't know how much of that is away. You've got two Alistair Cook series off the top of your head. I mean, I'm assuming we're throwing away things like Wally Hammond versus New Zealand. But there are some, you know, some incredible outlier performances from that perspective as well. Richard says, will McCullum last longer as red ball or white ball coach? And if he is moved on as red ball coach, then does the next coach try to carry on the template of Bazball? So yeah, I'm really interested in that myself. I just don't think he's going to want to do both the jobs for a long period of time. I just think that if he really was desperate to do it, they wouldn't have even looked at other coaches. So my assumption has always been that they went to him at first, asked him, he didn't show that much interest. They went, okay, we better find someone else. And then they came back to him later on when maybe some of their other options were not quite as available to them. And then maybe slightly more money was offered, or, you know, whatever it may be, better conditions. And he went for it. So I would assume now he's probably going to be a coach of both formats until he doesn't want to be. Like, I don't think he would quit from one format or the other. But regardless of who the next coach is, I think regardless of how it works, I think the next coach makes a lot more sense in that they are going to have to come in and decide very quickly what template they want. So for me, when I'm looking at hiring coaches, and I've been involved in a couple of searches, I think, my first thought is, what kind of cricket do we want to play? And can we find a coach to match that? And McCullum was a little bit different in that he said, this is the kind of cricket we're going to play. And then they hired him from that. So how does that work next time? Is his imprint so strong that you stick with that? I think whoever the next coach is, you're probably looking for someone, again, who's very aggressive, who's, you know, probably backs the players, wants to play entertaining cricket, because I think now England have decided that's what they want. Having said all that, it's going to be a different style. And I think that's what you want. I think the one thing that has really changed for me is, I remember it was a conversation with Brad Hodge when we were talking about St. Lucia, and I was so worried about all the different sides of being a general manager at St. Lucia at that stage. We're still in this season, but Brad Hodge was already thinking to next season because we already weren't going to go through. And I was thinking about, okay, I need to fill this position and this department needs to be created and we need to work with the, you know, local television companies and all this sort of stuff, as you do as a general manager. And also thinking, you know, what kind of players can I maybe swing for next year? All those sorts of things. And while I was doing all that, Brad Hodge was thinking, this is the sort of team I want to create because I think this will win the CPL. Can you make this team for me? And I think that's the kind of thing you're looking for a coach, which is, I think this is the thing that can win. This is what we have available to us. Now, let's put it together. And I think that's what you really want, is that vision from a coach, from that point of view. Josh says, how many wickets is Ajaz Patel going to take across these 6 test matches in Asia? He is going to take 120 wickets. I had to do the math, I think, there, as much as anything. Oh, is that other one on at the moment, actually? I hadn't checked. I know there was a wet outfield last time I checked. Okay, still delayed. So he might struggle if it's going to rain. I don't know what the full conditions are there, but I saw that draw was massively favored on the market. Let's have a look at what we've got here. Yeah, Afghanistan 28, New Zealand 3.5, and the draw at 1.47. So he might struggle to take all these wickets. Look, I don't think Ajaz Patel is like a fantastic bowler. I think he's very good in Asian conditions, but I don't think he's a great bowler by any stretch of the imagination. But he's going to bowl a phenomenal amount of overs, right? And he generally puts the ball in the right area and he understands those conditions. He would be hoping for 6 wickets a game, I would have thought. Probably more than that, but 6 wickets a game seems pretty fair across all of that. And then if he's bowling brilliantly and everything's coming out the way he wants it to, probably looking at 8 wickets a game, aren't you? If everything's absolutely firing, it's a long way to go. Shriram says, does the Indian men's cricket team tend to mix formats for players as soon as they show potential, regardless of whether they're more suited to one format or the other? Yeah, so I can see you're talking about here. Only Pujara is recognized as a test specialist. I think that's pretty common, isn't it? Cameron Green hasn't really done anything in white ball cricket, and Australia have played him quite a bit already. Zach Crawley's played ODI cricket, and I think probably hard to say based on his record, because based on his record, he shouldn't be in test cricket either. But, based on his record, it doesn't make as much sense. I think what teams are trying to do is there's probably only ever, and maybe a country like India is slightly different than this, but in general, there's probably only ever 10 to 15 to 25 players who are of international standard that you have available to you at any one time. The chances that you'll have 11 that are specialists in one format and 11 that are specialists in the other format's pretty low, I would say, right? If you've got a special talent, and I'll pick two players off the top of my head, Josh Hazlewood and Vernon Philander are two really good examples of guys that probably were underused because they were thought of as specialists. If you've got someone that good, you can throw them into that kind of white ball arena and get them to work it out. In Vernon Philander, like, South Africa really missed out on a pretty good number 8, right? Bowls 2 or 3 overs up top, maybe bowls a last one if you need it, but can come in and smash the ball towards the end of an innings as well. It gives you really lots of options. So the specialist side doesn't really work as well. And once you find out that someone has a special talent, teams generally are going to try and see if that, even if they haven't shown it in the other formats, if it works in the other formats. So Aaron Finch for Australia is a perfect example of someone that they just gave a go to that. Harry Brook, I don't know what Harry Brook's T20 numbers are, but Harry Brook is another one where England is just like, look, he looks like he should be able to play in T20 cricket. So let's give him a go in that. I suppose his domestic numbers aren't too bad. But do you know what I mean? Like, a lot of it was just how well he did at the international level in red ball cricket was why he came in. There were maybe even other players ahead of him. So I don't think it's an Indian thing. I think it's just the way that selectors think, which is if this guy's good enough to, you hear this a lot. If he's good enough, that was the David Warner, Dale Steyn situation where they didn't know if David Warner was a test player. But they did know that he was good enough to hit Dale Steyn with a flat bat over long on for 6. And so their theory was, well, if he can do that, why not we push him into test cricket and see how it comes? So that's no different to what you're talking about with the Indian situation. I think that's quite common. You see a talent of that level and you think to yourself, oh, maybe we can use it over here. And then also, the thing about international cricket is, the more of it you play, the more comfortable you are at that level. And so if you are trying to develop a player, one of the better ways of doing it is playing them in a bunch of T20s and Mondays, or vice versa. Bloody Bugger says, why did the early lawmakers of cricket choose to make the rules, that are basically impossible to judge by the human eye? LBW law was made over 200 years before DRS. In my opinion, it's completely unreasonable to expect a human to predict LBW in certain circumstances. Yeah, but I don't you know, there is no law that they could have come up with then or now that is completely airtight, right? I watch basketball all the time, and I watch one player will go up one end and will get some contact, and the referee will go, oh, that's a foul. Send him to the line. Then it goes up the other end, and the exact same thing happens, right? Any sport where there is an element of subjectiveness, and it's the same with football, basketball, I suppose sports like rugby and other sports, any sports where there's an element of subjectiveness, you're going to just have mistakes, right? Like that's part of it. It's built into the sport. If we didn't, I don't know what other LBW laws we could have had. I think maybe one mistake they made in cricket was they put crease lines up. I actually think they would have been much better to put lines down the middle of the wicket. I think that would have been a much smarter move. It would have told the umpires exactly where the stumps are. It's weird to me that even in lower level cricket, we don't do that now, right? This is where your stumps are. It's really interesting. We have like players to this day, like still marking guard. And it's like, can't we just mark guard? Can't we just put off stump, middle stump and leg stump there for them to begin the game? And have it all the way down so they always know roughly where it is. Like, I understand that on the crease line, it might wear out a little bit, but near the stumps and down the wicket, it should be fine. Now, it's possible that they tried this and that the ball skidded off the paint weirdly or whatever that may be. But you could certainly do it with turf, with AstroTurf and other kinds of synthetic wickets, which we still don't do. The point being is, I don't think there is a system that you would ever be able to tell all these things, right? Like, you either decide you want LBW or you don't. And for those who've never played in a game without LBW, it kind of is a bit crap. And it's not a particularly entertaining game watching someone stand in front of their stumps and then swing across the line knowing that they can't miss anything. So LBW is a huge step forward in the game. But in those days, of course, they didn't have to worry about the bounce as much also, because bowling was underarm. So LBW was probably easier when it was invented than it was up after that when balls started bouncing a lot higher and overarm bowling came in. Patrick says, is there a case for KL Rahul to be dropped from the Indian Test team? I don't think you'll ever find a time when someone isn't making a case for KL Rahul to be dropped from any side that he's in. We just did a big podcast on him the other day. He's averaging 34. I've gone into the deep dive a while ago to say that, you know, essentially he's one of those players where the numbers don't quite make all that much sense. But, you know, he's played, what, 9 tests in the last 3 years and really hasn't made a lot of runs. A lot of his runs come from earlier in his career. If they think they've got a better player, they should pick him. I mean, you know, I wouldn't make any different. That's kind of where you start this. Do you have someone else who can fill that role? What role is he currently fulfilling that they think they can get someone else? So last time he played was what, in Hyderabad, and he batted at number 4. And he batted against South Africa. So he's not even really in the side, is he? He's played 2 games this year. Or maybe they haven't played that many more tests. I'm trying to think of India's tests off the top of my head. I'm not even sure he's completely in the side. He played 1 game in January and then another game at the end of January. So they played a bunch of tests after that. Is he in the side? I don't think he is. There we go. Anyway, let's have a quick break here and we will come back with more of The Wagon. If you are following my work, we know that you are a true cricket sadist and you need your hit every day. And sometimes, sadly, there is actually no cricket to watch. So how about if someone made a very fun game that you could use for the moments when there is no on-field action? Welcome to Hit Wicket, a strategic game of cricket which isn't about slamming your finger on the screen very fast. You work out what works best based on how cricket actually works. Dot balls lead to wickets, 1s and 2s to 4s and 6s. So there is no way you can bowl a great Yorker every ball or smash 3 6s at the beginning of your innings. This is proper cricket. Yet it still has some gaming powers in there as well. Hit Wicket is about playing, but also building and managing your team. You are the batter, bowler, owner, coach, and captain. It's your dream. No ads, just cricket. So download Hit Wicket today, because this is a cricket game made for you and supported by major cricket nerds. All right, welcome back. Let's have a look here. All right, this is The Wagon Wheel, and I am Jared Kimber. And Ben says, aliens have descended down on Earth, finally. Sport-loving aliens, obvs. But they only want one new sport for the Galactic Empire. Jared, you've been chosen to represent Test cricket, and your job is to convince them that Test cricket is a sport they should adapt to. What do you say to them?
I probably would say that Test cricket... I like a lot of sports, and I don't think there's a bad choice as an alien subcommittee making this decision. But most sports are contained. They are winnable. They are knowable. You know, you can get to a certain point at which the game is understandable and can be tamed. You know, golfers can hit the ball a little bit further. Tennis players can hit the ball a little bit further. The angles on tennis serves, basketball and the way that we can map out a court, baseball and the understanding of what is important in baseball, all these sorts of things. I think Test cricket is probably the sport that doesn't allow for that. And it doesn't allow for that because of one key reason, right? We play on a surface of grass that essentially doesn't give a shit if we know all these things. So we can have a situation where one team can bat for about 3 hours, and in those 3 hours, it can be really, really hard to bat. And then as the last wicket is taken, the sun comes out, the conditions change, and suddenly that exact same surface reacts very differently than it did before. In some parts of the world, the opposite happens, of course. In some parts of the world, when the clouds are in, the wicket is together. And then as the sun comes out, it gets a little bit more inconsistent and cracks up. Everywhere is different. Everything reacts differently. We can't always tell what the conditions are going to do. We have a ball that if it goes out of shape, we can replace it with another ball that looks identical but acts completely differently. There's so many elements of cricket that are beyond the ability of humans or aliens to control. And that's what Test cricket is the epitome of, right? I think that's the best part of sport, right? Is the fact that you can't control it and that you have to adapt with what is happening there. And so for me, I don't think there is... Every other sport is almost finite, whereas Test cricket is the closest we have to, you know, infinite. It just goes on forever because of the inability to actually work out how to solve it. Right? And the other sports, of course, you solve it for a little while and something changes, and you solve it for a little while and something changes. You can't even solve it for a day sometimes in Test cricket. It's unsolvable. So therefore, it stays interesting forever in a way that other sports don't always. There you go. Sam, has anyone batted in as many positions across as many top-tier international IPL formats as Mo and Ali? I mean, I wouldn't even know where to look at that. But no, because the IPL didn't exist before Mo and Ali, right? Like, I mean, this is a new thing that has come in. We talk about the amount of formats and international and everything else. Probably not. But if you're asking if people have played in lots of positions before, well, Wilfred Rhodes batted in all 11 positions in international cricket. Has Mo and Ali batted in all 11 positions across the IPL and international cricket? I wouldn't have thought so. Shastri's 10, isn't he? And then you've got a lot of first-class players who've done similar sorts of things as well. Is Wilfred Rhodes the only guy who's played in all 11? I know he certainly has. I can't remember if there's anyone else who's done the same sort of thing. I was going to say Nathan Lyon would have, but I don't think he would have opened, would he? But he's probably come in a lot of different positions as night watchman over a lot of test matches as well. But yeah, Wilfred Rhodes was the first player to play in all 11 positions, and that's because he played for 1,000 years. William says, what do you make of the sell-off of 100 teams to private equity? Look, it's why the 100 and the Big Bash were set up, right? The Big Bash probably got some cold feet when Cricket Australia realized that once you let owners in, you no longer control anything. I think financially, Cricket Australia were probably in a, even though they don't have the ability to always make as much money as English cricket, they were probably in a stronger financial position at that stage, as in, you know, more consistent, more robust condition. Whereas making the 100 feels like it cost the ECB too much, and then coronavirus hit. So, you know, the combination of those two things happening at the same time probably really screwed over English cricket. So it makes sense that English cricket would be quicker to go to private equity in that case. But they were set up for this, right? They were set up for private investors eventually to come in. They wanted that money. That's where the real money is, really, is in that sort of side of things. Also, once you bring in private investment, you don't have to keep investing your money over and over again. The owners, the co-owners can help you out with everything, and it goes very differently. But once you do that, you no longer have control. I don't care if it's 49% or not. Someone pays 300 million, a billion, 1.5 billion for something. They have a huge amount of control over everything that is done from that moment forward. And that is what will happen to these teams. And that's why Cricket Australia hasn't done it yet. And the 100 is. So it will change things. And the more, you know, I've been saying this for a while, that the more owners who own multiple teams across multiple leagues, they become the most important people in cricket. And I would argue they already are. This is just another step towards them doing that. Ali says, would it make better sense to have the World Test Championship every year instead of every 2 years? Maybe it'll remain in the consciousness of the fans more. I don't think the final is, playing a final every year is going to change things all that much. It's really hard to play the amount of test cricket that you would need for teams to, you know, qualify correctly for this, Ali. So I think you'd have more randomness, and it's already not taken particularly seriously. So I think every 2 years is about right for me. Ben says, if an away team has 11 lefties and the home team has 11 righties, and the home team prepare the four quarters of the pitch differently, with the pitch in front of the lefties off stump being a minefield, so that's probably happened before. I think we've certainly seen situations where it's been left drier in India at times, probably for this kind of thing. I don't see really what the difference between that is and England or New Zealand putting extra grass on when, you know, they're in, like, it's all the same kind of a situation. If we're, you know, I think eventually, it's really weird to me that we have independent umpires that are trained and run by the ICC, but we don't have international oversight onto the pitches. So if a pitch is wrong, and something goes, you know, afterwards, we can have a look at it. But the pitches are, I would say, more important than the umpires. And yet we don't have any sort of oversight into how they are put together at the moment. But your question of, are there any limits on how much doctoring can be done? If the match referee thinks that is what has happened, he's within his rights to put in sanctions against the team. And the one thing I would say now is that it's probably, I won't say it's harder to pitch doctor, but it's, I think the ICC are more proactive. They're more proactive than they usually are at calling out wickets they don't think are great. So I think we're in a situation, and doctoring wickets is usually where things go wrong, because trying to actually doctor a wicket is it's kind of going against the muscle memory of the pitch, if you know what I mean. And so, you know, we take the Cape Town one as a perfect example of, you know, we're gonna do this thing to this wicket. But the World Cup semi-final, a final was another one, right? Where the Indians tried to change it, the curator tried to change it at the last minute. Didn't quite come out the way that they wanted. It actually ended up helping Australia as much as it was going to help India. The Cape Town one ends up being basically unplayable because, you know, they ask for some extra assistance and it goes all to shit. That's generally what happens when you try and doctor a wicket very late. These things sort of fall apart. So there's a natural justice that can happen, and then there's the sanctions. These two things are already in place, but I do think that if cricket was run properly, I would assume that we now know enough from the conditions of wickets prior, and, you know, especially international wickets, to be able to tell if a wicket's completely changed. And I just think it would be a much fairer process. And you would still have wickets that would be in favor of home teams. Nothing would actually change there. But yeah, that's probably the future, if that's what you're, if that's kind of where you're going there. All right, let's take another quick break here on the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber. I remain Jared Kimber for as long as possible.
NV Play helped me produce this content. For detailed performance breakdowns using their advanced technology when it comes to cricket and data, reach out to them today.
Welcome back. I am Jared Kimber, and this is the Wagon Wheel.
Got a couple more from Patreon. Bloody says, what is your all-time 11 that is made up of famous partnerships? Oh, okay. Well, it would be hard to do that, wouldn't it? Because you need a crossover partnership at one stage. I mean, there's so many with openers, isn't there? I suppose with openers, it would either be Simpson and Laurie or Haynes and Greenwich or Hayden and Langer. I suppose you could throw Sutcliffe and Hobbs in there. If you want the two best, you probably go Sutcliffe and Hobbs, right? But are the partnerships like at number three? Like how does that 3 and 4? Like Sachin and Dravid obviously had an incredible relationship, but do we think of them as like a partnership? And I don't think you would think of 5 and 6s as partnership. I'm trying to think of what the most famous 5 and 6 would be. Yeah, I can't think of any kind of like 5 and 6 partnership. 6 and 7's a little bit different, isn't it? I feel like 6 and 7 has probably existed. I'm trying to think of a really good 6 and 7 off the top of my head, though, that works as a partnership. Yeah, I'm not even sure there's a great 6 and 7. And then bowling, what would you have? I don't know. Laker and Locke, Jadeja and Ashwin. Those are probably the two obvious spinning ones. Unless I'm missing another. You've got the 4 spinners of India, but it's not quite the same. And then you can pick any of your opening ball combinations, right? So Walsh and Ambrose is a really good example. I suppose you'd have McGrath, Gillespie in there, Donald Pollock, Linwell Miller going back. Those are probably, and Wacker and Wasim if you wanted them as well. But yeah, I think the issue with your question, I think it works for bowlers and it works for opening batters. I don't really think of people as partnerships as that 3, 4, 5, 6. The only one I thought of as 3, 4, but I do kind of feel almost got to this level, is probably Williamson Taylor. It's probably because New Zealand didn't have opening batters all that much. But I can't think of anyone else that was kind of referred to in that kind of way. Yeah, because generally middle order batters are looked at individually or as a group, right, of 3, 4, 5, 6 or 4, 5, 6 or however. So like if you look at Misbah and Yunus, at the end we sort of thought about them together, but I don't know if they were thought of as a partnership earlier on. Josh says, hypothetical scenario. You, Bayram Estel, and 6 special guests are filming Crick Picks, all-time 100 test players, each drafting your own 11 with a bonus 100 honourable mention at the end. You're down to your final pick. Pleased with your selection so far of the quality, 5 batters, Les Ames at 6, spinner, and 3 pace bowlers, when you realise you've forgotten to pick an all-rounder. Ah, so I see the problem with your question already, Josh, because you say I haven't picked an all-rounder, but I have because I picked Les Ames. So I already have an all-rounder in my side. And I have no issue with having 5 specialist bowlers in a team here because I've got Les Ames at number 6, who averages whatever, 42, 43 with the bat, which is way higher than normal top 6s. Also, I'm assuming in my top order, I have some combination of Hobbs, Smith, Tendulkar, Bradman, Hammond, Headley, Barrington, etc. You know, Gavaskar, who, you know, just keep throwing names up there. So having a weak number 6, and he's not a weak number 6, but having a number 6 with a number 7 behind it who can't bat all that much, I have no problem. So I'm not going to pick an all-rounder for all-rounder's sake because I have an all-rounder in my side. So I wouldn't be looking for an all-rounder in that position because I only need 5 batters. And with my 5 bowlers, if I can get 5 top level test quality bowlers to me, I would win that game any day of the week. So I don't need an all-rounder. But then you've got, do I take a specialist batter or a special bowler? Just depending on what I need, right? At that stage. If I think my batting is a little bit light, so if I don't have Bradman and I don't have, you know, maybe some of the other, you know, top 5, top 10 batters of all time, which I should have, you know, if I feel it's a little bit lighter compared to the opposition teams, then yeah, you would pick probably a specialist batter to come in at number 6, and then you just move Les Ames down to number 7. And then you've got 4 great bowlers, so you're fine. But depending on the makeup of my bowling attack, if I think I need one more seamer or another spinner, and I would probably pick another spinner. I think a perfect 5-man attack is
three seamers, two spinners, and then you can switch that for certain Asian pitches. But in general, I would rather have two spinners rather than one spinner. But yeah, that's how I would go with it, and that's how I kind of look at those sorts of questions. All right, we'll have another quick break and I'll go through the comments, but that's the end of the Patreon questions. As I said, you can go support us on Patreon. Please do. It helps out a lot with all the content that we're making. This is brought to you by HitWicket, the cricket game that has playing and strategy all in your pocket. All right, Dynanesh, I think. Well, thank you for the super chat. Do batters lose form more easily than bowlers? It just feels like it's tougher for batters to get back into form than it does for bowlers. I think bowlers are more likely to lose form within a day than a batter. So I think if you watch, you might get a bowler who bowls a pretty good first spell and then comes back for the second spell and doesn't find their rhythm at all and then comes back for a third one because it's a different kind of job, right? Whereas for a batter, you're already out by the second spell. So we don't even know if you're in or out of form because you're away from the crease. So a lot of batting is very different in that it's final. So getting out there and making runs is kind of how you lose form in that kind of way. But you can, I think we talked about the other day on one of the podcasts, the Greg Chappell thing of keep getting out for ducks. We saw that stint where KL Rahul had the longest period of time of making double figures in T20 cricket history and then suddenly made a bunch of single figure scores. And so the easy thing to say then is he's out of form, but actually he's not. He's just getting out before he's set, which isn't the same quite as being out of form anyway. So I just think it's a very the two skills are very different and we look at them differently. And so what you're seeing there is really the projection that you have and that we have as cricket fans in general of what form is. Generally, there's a lot more that can go wrong, I think, with a batter than with a bowler. So, we're doing a project on Babar Azam at the moment. And to be able to work out what's wrong with him, I spent hours and hours on NV Play kind of going through, his setup. And he set up from 2019, he set up from 2016, and all these different things, looking at where his feet end up, looking at how open he is, how closed he is, are his hands different on the bat? Is his back lift the same? All these little things that you start to put together are looking for that. And bowlers have that, but also if you look, there's a general rhythm that they can bowl themselves back into. Whereas with a batter, you're trying to survive. So I think the way that form works in both is different. And essentially, all a bowler is trying to do, the vast majority of the times, is bowl near the top of off stump, right? Batting is a lot of a different art form to that. So I think there are probably more moving parts in batting from that perspective. And as long as you can wang the ball down at roughly 80 to 85 miles an hour, 90 miles an hour, 95 miles an hour in the spots that you're supposed to be, even if you're out of form, you still have the ability to be able to do that. But if you watch, you can see that there are times when the wrist isn't quite behind the ball, the left shoulder's dropping a little bit more, all those same things, but that might only be for like two overs and then they bowl themselves out of it, which is something you can't really do with batting because if you make a bunch of mistakes, your chances are you'll be out. Thank you for the super chat though. Fahim says, cricket seasons in different continents vary year round. Do you think this works as a negative for the sport since conditions and weather play such a big impact? No, I think it's a positive for the sport. I think it goes back to the question that someone asked before. When it comes down to it, cricket is largely unconquerable because of the pitches. Now, things might change with the hybrid wickets, and we did a big video on that on the main page recently, and I'm sure me and Bayram will be doing a show about that shortly. But overall, that's the position that we're in cricket, is that things do change quite dramatically. And that's a strength for the sport. You don't know. You turn up in Australia and you think, okay, we're going to Australia, hard, fast wickets, and this is what it's going to be. And it's not, right? West Indies, lots of teams were like, these are how the wickets are going to be in the West Indies. And we got some random wickets in the West Indies as well. That's the strength of the sport. I think that's the nux of why it's such a fascinating sport. So I think there are easier sports to follow, like football and basketball and rugby, right? Where you can kind of like, okay, it's
you know, in rugby, we're going this way and they're going that way. And in football, we're going to try and get the ball in the thing, and it's going to be quite exciting. And in basketball, there's going to be lots of scores, but, you know, it's all those things are quite interesting, but they're also, as I said before, knowable, right? So for a casual sporting fan, I almost think those are the better sports, right? But if you want to go deep, that's what cricket does. And it does it in part because you can walk out, you can see a wicket, you can know everything about what this wicket has done before. And from the first ball, you realize everything you realized was wrong and the game's going to be playing completely differently. So it's a really interesting blast quarter final the other day where Gloucestershire were up against Warwickshire or Birmingham. And the wicket just looked a little bit weird and tacky, and like the ball wasn't coming on perfectly. And I think Gloucestershire made like 135 or 140. They didn't make that many. And they were like 8 or 9 to 1. And I was sitting there going, I must be reading this wrong because I think they're massively in the game here. And Moeen Ali is the person that can end the game for Warwickshire. But if he's out, this could be a really, really interesting one. And the audience slash the commentators slash everyone else hadn't quite cottoned on for a long period of time at what had happened here. And you're talking about experts and fans, and you look at the market, right? We're talking about people investing. There was like $35 million invested in the Betfair market or something like that. And no one understood, right? And I was lucky. I just happened to pick it up, you know, pattern recognition or however my brain works. But most people, and I talked to a friend of mine who's I would trust him almost over anyone. And he was saying he thought it was Warwickshire's game all the way through. So you've got a situation there where even when everything was, you could see it, people were still not understanding the situation because they couldn't quite get their head around that wicket. That is what is brilliant about cricket, that it doesn't work the way. Do you remember, there's that old thing I used to hate when people would say this, always judge, you only judge a pitch when both teams have batted on it. It's like, well, that's absolute nonsense. Because pitches change when one team's bats on it and the other one does. And it happens all the time. So we see it sometimes in sessions. Look at the Pakistan-Bangladesh situation. They get them 6 down. That wicket eased off. It changed. The ball didn't move around as much. The energy was lost. Sometimes that happens. That's what's brilliant about our sport. Ben says, from the Fab Four, if we say Smith had the best career, I'm assuming we mean Test. Williamson the worst, comparatively. But who from the Fab Four has the second best career? If we're talking Test cricket, it's probably Root at the moment, isn't it? I think he's gone past Kohli. I don't think there would be, you know, Kohli can still go back past him, and who knows how long either of them will play and what the future is. But Kohli's last few years have been really, really poor. So I would find it hard that Kohli would be above Root at the moment. Hypercore says, where do you see the future of quality women's cricket coverage? With Twitter declining, competitors are yet to fill the forward, and traditional media is still substandard. Seems to be a big gap in the market. I mean, honestly, Hypercore, I would say that there's a big gap in the market right across so many different things in cricket media. And women's cricket is sadly just one of the parts of the game that isn't covered correctly. I don't know. You know, everyone knows that we've been... We did 99.94, and when we did 99.94, I think the first full month of activating, we had something like 600,000 to 700,000 views / listens. That's like a massive success for a startup, and we couldn't get any funding. Cricket 8, I don't know what the current numbers of Cricket 8 are, but it's just skyrocketing, the numbers, and the consistency of the views and the listenerships and all these sorts of things are going through the roof with really little funding. But again, we're having trouble funding the Cricket 8 situation. It's obvious what needs to be done, and it's obvious where you could make money off it. But what I haven't found is the only money I've ever seen really put into cricket media over the last little while is former player stuff and like sort of high-end stuff, which I never think is going to last a long period of time anyway. And for like SEO sites, right? Like sites who just put out absolute crap, but get enough people on them for SEO and end up really just being used by gambling sites to put up articles. And so that's the only places that seem to have any money or any interest. And it doesn't make sense. It really doesn't make any sense because, you know, I mean, women's cricket is bad, but I think the worst one is fantasy cricket. It's like, this is a $1 billion industry. And where is the good content on it? Right? Like, how much, if it's a $1 billion industry, why isn't someone just going, let's get the 10 smartest people in fantasy cricket together and make podcasts and articles and videos for them, with them? Like, there just seems to be so many obvious things to do in cricket. Languages. So many people in cricket follow cricket in a language where they don't have any form of analysis or anything outside of news in their language, like consistently. Then you've got women's cricket, you've got franchise cricket, barely written about. These players bounce around the world playing in all these different leagues, and CricInfo and CricBuzz don't cover them. No one covers them, right? It just, when I look at cricket media, that the amount of different issues that I have with it, and I wish I knew how to sort it out, Hypercourse, but I don't, right? And Cricket 8, that's my second real attempt at trying to fix something like this. Obviously, I also have the, you know, Good Air is now a different kind of business than what we were doing with 99.94. Cricket 8 is slightly different again. But I know that the audience is out there, and I know that the market is out there, and I know you can make money off all these things. But getting anyone to invest in them seems almost impossible at the moment. And I sit here as a sports media or cricket media business owner, not really being sure how to answer that question, because I can't see anything shake loose. And when the money is being spent, it's spent in such stupid ways that just doesn't make any sense to me. Anyway, AB says, do you think a big reason why KRL plays the way he does is the amount of trolling he faces? Or have you or anyone else, do you know, tried to understand the effect of trolling on players? I would be very doubtful that he went from being an incredibly attacking player to a anchor because of trolling, because that doesn't make any sense. That's how he played. I would say that is more to do with the culture of the cricket climate and everything else. And then one thing we do see with players is there's a regression in their strike rates quite a lot when they get to the international level, once they realize that all they need to do is keep the scoreboard ticking over and they will continue to get their money. I think, you know, let's call that the Dean Jones effect. Dean Jones absolutely had to destroy ODI cricket to get any attention in Australia, and did that. And then afterwards played quite defensively, which is a shame, because a rampaging Dean Jones was a much better player. But I think he was worried that if he did go through a form slump, that he would be kicked out, and he knew he could score at a slower rate and make runs. So I think that's the bigger thing. Look, there's no doubt that the effect of trolling is out there. I don't think... I don't think it's as much different. So before, you might have multiple newspapers writing about you when you're in bad form. And now you have people online. The directness is slightly there, but the impact isn't all that different. The personal stuff is very different. And I think there is certainly an element of the personal stuff not being ideal. But when it comes down to it, I think that cricket is... like that all professional sports, it's part of the reason that you're paid a lot of money is to deal with the crap, right? People would play, as we know all the way through, amateur-wise, people would play the sports for nothing, right? It's putting up with the shit that you have to put up with is where the money comes in. And the trolling isn't going to go away, right? But it does impact some players, and it doesn't impact others. I think in some cases it changes the way people play. But I can't see how it would change the way that KL Rahul would play to this style. Busky, you said that Test cricket is unsolvable. Could you explain table tennis patterns and theory, even any analysis at first glance, if you do not follow the game? Well, I play table tennis, but I'm not an expert in table tennis, but the table doesn't change, Busker. right? So in football, baseball, basketball, rugby, name your sport, right? It does, the actual playing surface stays the same. Even in sports like tennis and golf, where you have subtle changes, golf's, I think, very similar to cricket in that it has maybe one of some of the more extreme changes. But you probably, it's probably more to do with the fact that someone plays in the morning in golf and someone plays in the evening in golf. And so because of those two different things, you might get, you know, some weather in the morning and some weather in the afternoon. And tennis maybe has something similar to that. Whereas cricket has that within the one game. You are literally playing against other people on the conditions that can change. And then the wicket is changing far quicker than it does in golf, right? And the vast majority of the golf course doesn't change that much. It's more the greens that change specifically. What's what I'm talking about with table tennis? The table doesn't change. The table is the same size everywhere you go. It's made of, I would assume, roughly the same kinds of surfaces. But you might have slightly different variations depending on different places. But tennis has that, right? So tennis is harder. And that's why tennis can be quite interesting where that sort of, unfortunately, over the years, tennis has gone towards more slower surfaces because that is better for long rallies, which people like on TV. But, you know, if you have that sort of great period where we still had lots of grass courts, we had synthetic grass courts, we had clay, hard courts, all those different kinds. I always thought that was the most interesting sort of period. And then it's kind of dulled down a little bit now that we don't have some of those other surfaces as much. But again, you still have four surfaces or five surfaces in tennis that you roughly know what they are going to do every single time, right? In cricket, you can be out playing in the whacker, and everyone is smashing short balls left, right, and center, and then suddenly a crack opens up and one runs along the ground, and that's the end of your day and maybe your match, right? It's unsolvable. You can't solve that problem. You can prepare to go to clay. Right, you can prepare for different kinds of table tennis styles. You might be taken completely off guard by a player who comes up with a new pattern, and that can happen in football or in basketball and all these sorts of different sports, which is fine. You know, you watch the Sacramento Kings in basketball, and it's like trying to follow the ball movement and the patterns that they're doing is really hard if you're a defender, right? So you have to handle that, but you can then watch them and do that. You can't. What was it? Was it the Shoaib Bashir, was it against West Indies or Sri Lanka in the first in one of the tests? Where just early on day one, for no reason at all, the ball rolls along the ground. That is unsolvable, Basker. You cannot handle that. You come forward to a ball that is pitched up. It's a lovely ball and it takes off. One ball, Ashwin puts maximum revolutions on it and it jags back. The next ball, he puts maximum revolutions on it and it skids forward. That is what we are talking about. It's an unsolvable sport. And I've never done any analysis on table tennis, but I can tell you this. If I had ball tracking software in table tennis, I could probably give you all the different sorts of patterns that everyone did, and I'd be fairly close. When we take test cricket to big data companies, do you know what they say? We don't know what to do with this sport. And as far as I'm aware, it's the only sport where the big data companies are like, they don't even want to be involved in test cricket. I think there was a company the Cricket Australia took it to, and they called it the monster. They didn't know what to do with it. Unsolvable. Rahul says, how do you rate Pathan Nisankar? That's a really good question. I just feel like he's a player that I don't have strong enough views on at the moment. And I think he's a well above average talent. And one of the things I like about him is that he's 20, I'm just looking him up now, 25, 26. Yeah, so he's just turned 26. We've seen in ODI cricket that what he does is quite repeatable. I don't know if he always has a fifth gear. So in one-day cricket and T20 cricket, there's probably a bit of a ceiling there. But in the other formats, I think he's, well, in the rest of the game, so earlier in one-day games, the ability at his age to already be averaging over 40 at a strike rate of near enough 90, I think is fantastic. And in test cricket, we maybe just haven't seen him be consistently dominant as we would like yet. But again, we can see the talent.
the fact that he's already, I don't know how many international games has he played here, like 120 odd international games, right? The fact that he's played 120 odd international games and is at the level that he's at already, and he's about to hit his peak, I would suggest the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to see some massive numbers from him. I think maybe we're talking low to mid 40s in Test cricket, although over the last couple of years, that's huge, especially for a top order player. But I think he can bump his ODI record up even higher. I don't know if he's ever going to be a great player, right? Or even a great Sri Lankan player, but I think he can be a Karuna Ratna level player without any issues. And I'd be really fascinated to see how he develops when it comes to that. Anurag says, what could be a realistic test window in practice and what would it look like? 2 months in England summer and 2 months in the Australian summer. Doesn't sound like something that would work out well considering cricket seasons in different countries. Yeah, I think the biggest issue is, it depends on what you mean, Anurag. If you are talking about, I think in the future, the two things that will probably get windows is going to be the IPL and international cricket. So at that stage, you have to make some real decisions when it comes to how you want to develop those international cricket and go forward with it. If you do it that way, there's probably quite a few windows to have 4 test matches. And there's a couple of ways of doing it. There is like having like little carnivals where there are, you can usually play test cricket in, it's very rare that you can only play it in one part of the world at one time. So, you know, if you look at, I don't know, November to February, you've got all the subcontinent that you can play in. You've got all the Southern Hemisphere that you can play in. And then you have the, I think the West Indies, it was around February, March. Is there better season off the top of my head? So I think you've got quite a few periods there that you can go. So quite often you have that, you know, when you play cricket in the West Indies, you can usually play it in England, for instance. And again, the subcontinent is almost 12 months of the year. So from a season point of view, you can do stuff like that. Not everything's great though. Obviously there are certain times of the year that it doesn't work in certain places and everything else, but you could come together with a season. But I don't think you're going to get a season in a, like a football style that you're talking about, that 2 months sort of thing. I think what you will get is probably, let's say the IPL, based on everything we know at the moment, is probably going to come, I would say, almost makes sense for the IPL to start in February, start of February. I'm talking about like a 6 month IPL here and go through to, you know, July, early August or something like that. If they're ever going to have like the big long thing, which we all assume they'll eventually get to. That would then give you enough time for the Southern Hemisphere countries and the Northern Hemisphere countries to play internationals. But by that stage, the sport is so changed anyway, that it's a kind of a conversation that's hard to have, right? Like the world is different at that point. So we'll have another quick break and I'll see if there's anything else in the chat. But I'm Jared Kimber and this is Wagon Wheel.
NV Play's tools make cricket data accessible to everyone. They assisted me in making this and support many international cricketers access their software on their website for valuable insight.
All right. Music and Stuff says, you must feel brilliant as Shanto and DDS, your two favorites, working their way up the international cricket as test captains there. Probably didn't expect either of them to be test captains. Look, Shanto is still a frustrating watch when it's not working for him, but clearly there are a lot of things coming together with him. And I really like his thought processes and what a moment for him recently in Pakistan. And Dhananjay De Silva, I've said from the start, Dhananjay De Silva is just a proper professional cricketer in all three and now all four facets of the game. You know, really, really excited because they're two cricketers I like to watch. And so well done to both of them. Sag says, can you give a few good betting markets in India? Well, I mean, I don't really know. I've never had to bet in India, so I'm not really sure how all that works. I only bet in the UK. I'm not even sure if legally I'm allowed to bet other places. I don't even know how all that works. I bet on the Betfair exchange in the UK, or I trade on the Betfair exchange in the UK. And then I have a few other betting accounts that I can bet on, although one of them was shut down because they said that I was too good at betting. Maybe you should have been better with your odds. I don't know. Isn't that the idea? Bet responsibly? Did I bet too responsibly? Anyway. But yeah, I don't know much about the markets in India other than that, you know, a lot of people bet over there.
Sanjay says, have you heard Navjot sing Sidhu's commentary? Yes. I mean, it was incredible because it was almost a word salad at times, but a lyrical word salad, right? The ones I remember is the fox is cunning, but the chicken hath wings. And I've been thinking about that for years because chickens don't really fly. And the other one he said butter through a knife. And the commentator the co-commentator pulled him up on it. And he went, no, I said it right. And I don't know. It was bizarre. It was kind of Danny Morrison before Danny Morrison, right? Like, I don't know if we'd ever had a commentator like Navjot Singh Sidhu. Me and all my friends were absolutely obsessed with him. It was probably, he probably stops commentating. I know he had I don't know exactly what happened, but, you know, traffic collision that ended up in, was it a manslaughter charge or whatever it was with him, and that seems to have slowed down his media career. But up until that point, he commentated a lot. It was just before we started the blog, I think, when he stops, or maybe when he start, you know, he stops being involved as much. But he was an absolutely fascinating listen, right? I'm not sure I ever remember him telling me much about the cricket, though, but I do remember the sort of way he went about it. He reminds me of, I think it was, was it a famous football? No, it was a ice hockey commentator who used to just like gerrymander in movie references into it. And you're like, I mean, it's quite entertaining on like short clips and listening on YouTube and everything else. But how does that actually work for like someone who has to listen to it, like, you know, in cricket for 7 hours? And I'm not saying it doesn't, like, but I just wonder if you were listening to Navjot Singh Sidhu consistently, how that would have affected your enjoyment of the game. But in, like, I can only imagine if he was commentating major cricket now, like the GIFs, the clips, it was commentary on a different level. And, you know, we've seen people like Kerry O'Keefe and Bumble, you know, try and be funny. I don't mean try and be funny as if they're not funny, but I mean use comedy as a method. And we've seen other people be very lyrical with the way that they speak. I suppose Danny Morrison is a perfect example of, you know, trying to be alliterative and, you know, again, you know, being dramatic. Then you've got people like Jeremy Coney, you know, almost like narrating from the start of a movie at times. Navjot was just like a different version of all that. And he was almost like a TikTok commentator, like generations before his time. The Fireball says, hey, Jared, is it a good idea if the umpire's call gives the benefit of the doubt to the batter? No, the umpire's call should be there. I hate the benefit of the doubt of the batter. I don't even understand why the benefit of the doubt would ever go to the batter. He's trying to get the decisions right, not keep batters in. The umpire's call should go on based on what the umpire believes is correct. The reason we use it is it's a little bit more information to try and get our decisions overall more correct. So why would we then gerrymander that or twist it to make sure that it only helps one style of cricket? That's not for me, Fireball. That's not for me. Anyway, I am Jared Kimber. This has been The Wagon Wheel. Remember, Good Areas Podcast, we come to you almost daily with all sorts of content, and you can find us on this channel and everywhere else. I had a really cool video go up about Joe Root and sort of the mathematical connotations of what happens when you age, and so that we can try and map out exactly how many tests it would take him to beat Sachin Tendulkar and how long that would take and everything else. But let's see how it goes anyway, but it's a fascinating video. And we've had some other videos coming up. We're working on a Babar Azam one as well. And we've got a bunch more podcasts lined up for you as well. But I'm Jared Kimber, and this is the Good Areas Podcast Network. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes.
please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minvo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minvo.pro now.